The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, will today be the day that someone gives Ole Gunnar Solskjaer some credit? How can you outthink Pep just days after failing to think at all against Crystal Palace? What's the most surprising thing about Fulham's win at Anfield? Perhaps that it wasn't a surprise. And when will people stop giving Jurgen Klopp a free pass just because he won the league and the Champions League? At the bottom, do West Brom or Newcastle deserve any points for delivering that complete shower? And in the race for Europe, Gareth Bale is good again. We'll have an extended fit bar corner as Rangers win the title. Is it all down to Steven Gerrard? There's curious goings on at Football Index. Curiouser goings on in the vote for the president of the Confederation of African Football. And where are footballers getting their haircuts? All this, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thanks. Hello, Marcus Bean.
Hi, Max.
And hello, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Right, let's start then at the Etihad, shall we? Manchester City 0, Manchester United 2. City's 21-game winning run, their 28-game unbeaten run comes to an end. Were they comprehensively outplayed by Manchester United, Jonathan? And how did they manage that?
Yeah, I think they were. And it really, I think if you're a City fan or involved with City, the worrying thing or the frustrating thing would be these are failings we've seen from them before, that they go behind early. And I think we've seen with Guardiola sides over the last decade, there has been a tendency, if they concede one goal, it's like the mechanism can't cope and they have sort of 10 or 15 minutes of panic. And so if you think back, a lot of those Guardiola sides defeats, particularly in the Champions League, they've conceded two or three goals in a sort of 10 or 15 minute period. And you saw that first half of the first half, City were terrible. Kevin De Bruyne couldn't pass the ball 10 yards. And I think the reason for that, and maybe this is an oversimplistic way of looking at it, but the nature of Guardiola's side is it's this finely honed mechanism. It's a series of cogs. And so there's a lack of leaders on the pitch. And I think that's particularly true now that Kompany's gone. So you don't have the individuals there to drag a team through a difficult period. And so I think there is a tendency, if it's knocked out of kilter, it takes quite a while for them to get back. Now, United didn't score a second goal in that 20 minutes, but that would be a worry. And then City looked incredibly vulnerable on the break, which is the big problem they've always had, that the balls in behind them do catch them out. Now, it looked like they'd sorted that out this season. Well, they got caught out again and again by United. And to be honest, if United had counterattacked better, they'd have won it more than 2-0.
So it's sort of like an error. It's like, this is such a perfect team that are so perfect that if something goes wrong, they all just panic because they're just so not used to ever being behind or anything wrong.
That's one part of it. But then there is this persistent problem with the balls in behind them. So if you think back to, think of last season, Wolves beat them twice. How did they beat them? Balls in behind them, Adama Traore running on. You think of why Leicester caused City problems because Jamie Vardy's so good at running in behind them. You look even Norwich when they beat them last season. It was Pukki and Cantwell running in behind them. So that's a persistent problem. Now, we thought that by dropping a little bit deeper, by not pressing quite so intensely this season, City had sorted that out. And I have to say, the one doubt, and I think we mentioned it at the time, the one slight doubt I had, even in that 21-game run, was the game against Liverpool. The goal they conceded was a really simple ball over the top, which leads to an admittedly soft penalty. So I did wonder then, have we slightly overplayed this? And I mean, it's ridiculous. It's 21 games. But you look down that list of 21 teams. Who have they actually beaten? I know it's a preposterous thing to say. But they met Chelsea when Chelsea were at their most rubbish. They met Liverpool when Liverpool were at their most rubbish. They met Tottenham when Tottenham were their most rubbish. And the others were all teams you just expect them to beat. So look, to win 21 games in a row is amazing. To achieve that level of consistency against anybody is extraordinary. But perhaps, as 21 game winning runs go, it's not the greatest 21 game winning run.
Ed, do you think Solskjaer has something over Pep? Like he seems to have he has a good record against.
Oh, can I give you a stat on this?
Yeah, there are other people on the pod, but yeah, fire away, Jonathan.
But this is a good stat, I think. There are, and I'll shut up for 5 minutes after this, I promise.
Okay, great.
There are 64 managers who've played against Guardiola in four or more games. Solskjaer is the only one with a positive record. Finished.
I already knew that, actually, because I just desked Jonathan's blog.
So,
I'm not going to be taking credit for it.
Can you have too much Wilson, Ed? You're going to find out in a minute.
I wouldn't do that. I love it. No, I think absolutely. Yeah, I think obviously it played into their hands though perfectly, didn't it? Because in the first, 30 seconds, it was a penalty to United, and it was brilliant because I was listening on the radio I watched it on TV and I saw the penalty, and then I went out to walk my dog, and my radio was still on the kickoff had just happened because I had been listening to my radio, so I got to hear Robbie Savage saying, oh yeah, there's only one team that's going to win this game, and then he's like, oh no, it's a penalty to United. And it was absolute poetry. So yeah, but it really played into Solskjaer's hands, because United are excellent at playing on the counter attack and organising and defending away from home. 22 games unbeaten away from home is amazing. I think that's the third best in history in the Premier League. Jonathan, is that right? Something like that.
I'm not allowed to speak for 5 minutes. You carry on.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Something like that. So yeah, I mean, they're obviously well equipped to play, to protect a 1-0 lead, and they fully deserved it. And they've done it a couple of times, haven't they? Ruined the party for City.
And Marcus, I mean, Manchester United had some really brilliant individual performance in this game. Martial had a great game, and I feel like there's sort of continual talk about whether he's the right person to lead the line for Manchester United. And if he could play like that every week, he could save them £200 million and more.
Yeah, definitely. As we all know, there's a top player inside there somewhere in Martial, but it's just, as with all top players, about consistency. If you want to be a top player, you have to be consistent, and that's one thing that Martial isn't. I thought he was excellent the other day. He had a real willingness to run off the ball, which he's often criticised for. He held the ball up well, drew fouls, got his team up the pitch, and when you're playing against Man City, that's exactly what you want. You want players that can get you up the pitch quickly and retain possession, and that's what he done. So yeah, you're right. If they can somehow get him playing like that consistently, they will be able to save themselves a lot of money.
That consistency thing is interesting, Marcus, isn't it? How do you, is that just a confidence thing for him? Like, if you're good enough to do it on one day, you presumably should be against the best defence in the country. You should be good enough to do it on the next day. Is that just a confidence thing? Is that just being up for it? What is it?
I think consistency comes from every part of your life. So it's not just on the pitch. It's about how you live your life day to day to make sure that you get the best performance. So I'm not too sure how he trains, how he eats, how he lives, but these are all the important things you need to be doing in order to turn up on a Saturday and perform at your highest level. So honestly, I think it's down to how you the repetition and doing the right things consistently. And that's how you eventually have put in performances like that.
And were you like markedly consistent in your career?
I was very consistently average, but consistent. But for all the same reasons I just mentioned there, I was very dedicated. I knew I had to be, because I didn't have the ability of some of the players around me. So I knew I had to do everything right off the pitch in order to get, that 6 or 7 out of 10 every week on it.
Martial's interesting. He does strike me as kind of a natural. Since I first saw him, I don't think many people had seen him play when he first, came on the scene and signed, as a teenager for United. And just the first time, he scored, was it against Liverpool he scored on his debut? Almost from the first touch, the way that he glides with the ball is just so natural. But it's definitely down to the consistency, and perhaps mentally he's just not there for the smaller games, and he gets himself up for the big games. I don't know, but I agree, there's a really great player in there that we should see more of.
You may come back to the pod if you want, Wilson, and to talk Luke Shaw. Lem says, is Luke Shaw starting for England in the summer?
Maybe, yeah. I'm trying to think who the other candidates are. England have so many players, it's really hard to keep track of them all.
So who's in contention? Chilwell?
I mean, if Chilwell doesn't play regularly, perhaps. Not a left-back, surely. I mean, maybe, but... Yeah, Chilwell, I guess, is the obvious.
Matt Target or Cresswell, maybe.
Cresswell or Target. Okay, so Shaw's above them, you presume.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say Shaw will start, because he's just got that defensive... Well, now he's got a lot more solid. And it kind of defends if we play 4 at the back or 5 at the back.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. If Chilwell doesn't appear to be playing regularly for Chelsea, I know he's played the last couple of games, But he's not playing at left back anyway. He's playing at wing back. So, yeah, if Southgate wants a left back, Shaw would appear to be the man in form playing in the right position.
Yeah, he played really. Wan-Bissaka had a great game as well. Debates about whether he decides to play for Congo or England. You watched him grow up, Ed, didn't you, Wan-Bissaka?
For a season.
Oh, that's close enough.
18 months. Yeah, it's an interesting question for him because, you know, he's been in an England squad already, hasn't he? And I think he withdrew with injury. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of competition in that position. But I don't know. I think he's shown he's really grown into being Man United's right back. I think he's had a lot of criticism over the year, but I think he's started every game this season. Or he's one of the players in the league that played the most minutes this season anyway. And he's maybe not as thrilling going forward as some of the other right backs that England have got, but as a defender, I don't think there's a better one around.
This is a tweet that I've said comes from Ole, but I don't think it does, but maybe it does. Is the pod going to ignore how well Ole has done to clear up many bad eggs from the Louis van Gaal, Jose eras to create a United squad that's playing better football, able to beat great Liverpool and Manchester City teams of the last 2 years? Still a way to go in the project, but easy to forget how bad we were, / toxic it was. I suspect that came from someone else and I wrote Ole by mistake, unless Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wants us to praise Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Wilson.
Well, okay. I mean, there's two bits of a question here that I don't entirely accept. So the first is this Ole, whoever it is who's tweeted, he does remember Manchester United went out of the Champions League, right? He does remember that before yesterday, they'd scored one goal in 7 games against the Big Six. He does remember that recently, within the last 3 or 4 weeks, they failed to beat Sheffield United, West Brom and Crystal Palace. Like, all those things did happen. So one good result doesn't sort of obliterate all of them. And secondly, I think United's squad now does look a lot better, a lot better balanced, a lot more united than it did 2 or 3 years ago. But to what extent is that Solskjaer's doing? And to what extent is it people above him? And if we're giving him praise for reshaping the squad, who takes responsibility for Donny van de Beek?
Well, I'm not.
Okay, that's fine. I'll cross you off the list. Anybody else?
I'd love to, but... Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure what's happened there. He's completely forgot about him, actually.
But, you know, players sometimes work or they don't. You know, that happens sometimes. But no, I take your point, Wilson. I will send it back to Ole. Thank you for tweeting us directly. Let's go to Anfield. Liverpool 0, Fulham 1. Mario Lemina's first half strike. Enough for the win. Liverpool's sixth home defeat in a row. Fulham deserved it. 68 games without defeat for Liverpool at home, then 6 straight defeats. I know you're a red, Marcus. I mean, that is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I've got to be honest, when I saw the lineup, I did have it down as a Fulham win. Not only are we playing very poorly, but then you put out a team like that with the changes that he's made, then I was not confident at all. And questions, listen, Klopp's got more than enough credit in the bank. We all know that. But definitely certain questions have to be asked in terms of sticking rigidly to the 4-3-3, sticking rigidly with the high line, which with 2 slow centre-backs, it's a recipe for disaster. So, listen, I think we know that the team's had a lot of injuries, but when next season they need to start on the front foot and start raring to go with the likes of Van Dijk, Gomez back, I think it'll make a big difference, but it needs a very good start next season. This season's a write-off now. I don't think we're going to make top four. Hopefully we can nick the Champions League, and it would be a big turn up for the books if we did. But yeah, it's just all about next season now, and maybe, yeah, just preparing for that.
They're the first Premier League team since Huddersfield to lose 6 home games in a row, closer in points to Fulham in 17th than they are to Manchester City. Rob Gutman, who's from the Anfield Wrap, who's sort of not a mad hyperbole fan, tweeted yesterday, "This is fundamentally not acceptable for a club of our status. Change, horrifically sad as it is, has to come now." Can you see a situation, Ed, where Jurgen Klopp would leave?
Well, it's very hard to see. I think he, you know, everything that he's done there, he deserves another chance in a normal season, you know, with people like Van Dijk and Gomez back. I think to sack him now would just be yeah, I mean, I just couldn't imagine it. No, I mean, obviously, there's a bit of a clamour for Gerrard, given, you know, won the title yesterday with Rangers and everything. I just think it's probably a bit too early for that. I think, and Klopp would himself surely want to try and, you know, have another go. But the big question, I think, is about the front three in particular, and how long they can, you know. Well, I think there's probably their time together is almost up now. That's what they need to move on from. And the question marks over Salah and Mane, whether they'll still be there next season. I think one of them might go, actually. But obviously the financial implications of trying to buy one of those two is going to be massive for anyone who tries to. So that's the sort of the stumbling block, which might mean that they have to make do with what they've got. I don't know. It's really interesting proposition. Yeah, you know, the next few months are going to be really interesting to see how they come out of this.
I think this is great news for UEFA, because they're launching this new tournament next season, the UEFA Conference League. And as I understand it correctly, if Manchester City win the Carabao Cup, then sixth in the league will take England's place in that. So Liverpool could be the inaugural winners. And for one of the European elite to consecrate that new tournament, I think is tremendous news for everybody.
What's
and
it
Liverpool,
called?
I'm not quite sure which way around the
world. The Vauxhall Conference.
Conference and League in some kind of order. I'm not sure exactly which order. And yeah, Liverpool then could legitimately, you know, say they have a set that no other team has ever achieved.
Liverpool's next four home games are Villa, Newcastle, Southampton and Palace. So if they lose all of those, I mean, they've been given a fixture list to say you can have a win after Villa, who are good, right? Then it's just have a victory, right? One is on us. We'll get you out of this hole. But
you know that you know when Klopp had that row with Chris Wilder back in mid-December.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, Chris Wilder's won four league games and Klopp's won three. How ridiculous is that?
Yeah. Well, Marcus mentioned it there, and there's a question from El Capitan saying, why is Klopp so stubborn with his tactics? How is there no mutiny in the dressing room already? Not just injuries, but 4-3-3 is not suitable anymore, especially with Thiago. Many teams have cracked the system.
But I mean, how easy... I mean, Marcus, maybe you can kind of answer that better than any of the rest of us, but how easy is it mid-season, when you've had such a defined way of playing, to switch to something different? I mean, even something like just not playing such a high line, dropping deeper. Yeah, we saw City have done that, but there was a lot of sort of transition. They didn't play well that first or a couple of months of the season. So how plausible is that as something Liverpool could do?
I think with the quality of player you've got and the intelligence that they've got in that room, in the building at Liverpool, it's not ideal. You want to do these things in pre-season, but you know, with a solid week of tactical training, but doing 11v11, shadow play, you should be able to go from a 4-3-3 to a 4-2-3-1. A lot of these players have played it before at previous clubs. It's not that difficult to change. I think it's more difficult with players that, you know, aren't tactically aware, but these guys are top of their game, you know, paid hundreds of thousands a week. They should be able to adapt quite easily to change into from a 4-3-3 to a 4-2-3-1.
But what about just not pressing as hard? What about dropping slightly deeper and especially when you've got 19 different centre back combinations this season? I think it is now.
I think players find it easier defending deeper. I think it's actually an easier transition to do that than to go from a deep line to a high line, because there's a lot more nuances in terms of how much pressure's on the ball, how high, then when do you need to drop? I think when you're deeper, it's just, you just got to just plug gaps and see players in front of you. I think it's a lot easier to transition from a high line back to a deep line. So they should be able to do it quite comfortably.
So there's not a danger that they get really stretched, that the front line's still doing, you know, still pressing too high?
No, because you just tell them, listen, this is where I want you to start pressing from. And you literally, we used to do it when I was at certain teams. There was a hoarding, and especially if you're at home, you just know where the hoardings are. Listen, start here and then press from there. I think it's quite an easy transition to make.
Do you think it's harder then in the Premier League because they've got those electronic hoardings that are changing? So you press from Nando's and then that's suddenly not there anymore. And it's, you know, it's like a tyre sponsor.
I'm showing my age now, aren't I?
Ed, from Fulham's point of view, I mean, this has been coming, hasn't it? They're a good side, and they, you know, they, I think they, They break well. I think Lookman and Loftus-Cheek are really exciting, and I think everybody likes Scott Parker, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been really great actually watching their evolution this season. From, you know, everyone was sort of expecting them to concede a hatful with Tim Ream and Michael Hector as the centre backs at the start of the season, and it's just absolutely been transformed. And I have to mention, you mentioned Lookman and Loftus-Cheek, and some of the attacking players are starting to find their feet now, like Madger as well, Josh Madger. But I think the real transformation in that team has been Joachim Andersen, from who's on loan from Lyon, is a Denmark defender, and he's been amazing. Every time I watch them, just he's the leader of that team, not just at the back. You know, he took a free kick the game I went to last week, and it, from like 35 yards and just past the post. He just leads by example, and, you know, pings passes out to Lookman all the time out on the left, and he just causes havoc. And it was it really is encouraging to see how they've developed as a side over this season in quite a short space of time, really, you know, in an intense programme. And they've just got lots of good players.
He made one brilliant sort of block across, didn't he, yesterday, that was sort of goal-saving. And I think Harrison Reed as well has really impressed me.
And Lamina as well. You have to, because at times, you know, Lamina's got all the talent in the world, but just his application's not been there since that much since he's been in England. But really seeing how good a player he can be as well, you know, and there's a lot of competition in that midfield now.
They're level on points with Brighton, 1 point behind Newcastle. They have played a game more than both those two sides. Does everyone think they'll survive? Marcus, do you think they'll survive for them?
Yeah, I think they'll survive, and I hope they do. I think what Scott Parker done is realised quite early on that he needed a lot more pace, energy in his team, and he went out and recruited. I think he's done excellent with recruitment, and I think they're a real threat in and out of possession. They're able to play the ball and pass it around really well, but they're also able to counter, so he's got a really good mix. I think they'll stay up, and I hope they do.
I guess their biggest issue might be if they somehow are listening to like lots of people like us saying they'll survive and thinking they're definitely safe. David says, can we discuss Scott Parker's attire? What was that? It was a kind of smart jacket with the air of a puffer jacket. Or was it a puffer jacket with the air of smart? I couldn't...
No, was he not wearing a gilet underneath a jacket? Was that not...
It looked to me like the jacket itself was kind of... It was like a suit jacket, but made out of a puffer material.
I quite liked it.
You liked it, did you?
Yeah, I liked it. A little bit too tight. So the top button was kind of bulging, trying to escape. Yeah. But it was nice jacket. I'm having it.
Let's end part one. And in part two, we'll begin by covering off the relegation fight. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Fulham's win means more pressure on Brighton and Newcastle. Neither of them won. West Brom nil, Newcastle nil. Sean says, was West Brom Newcastle the worst game of football ever? And I watched this in the office before I did a radio show, and it was so painful that we don't have to talk about it at all. He does carry on by saying, are pundits willing to accept the Newcastle fans were right about Bruce not being very good? Ed?
Well, yeah, I was disappointed because I thought this game wasn't on TV because I couldn't find it anywhere. And I was like, oh yeah. Then I realised it was on Amazon, and I turned it on, and it was awful. It was absolutely awful. So I quickly turned it off again. Yeah, I think the way things are looking, it just looks inevitable, doesn't it, that Newcastle are going to go down. And the thing about Bruce was as well, after the game, he was so upbeat about their getting a point and how they'd found a way to, you know, without... I do have some sympathy for him because they have lost some really good attacking players. So you have to mention, you know, but just his enthusiasm for getting a point at West Brom was too much, I thought. And I just thought this is really not going to go down well with Newcastle fans.
Marcus, can we talk about Treason Gate and Matt Ritchie apparently calling Steve Bruce a coward and there being some sort of, you know, very minor brawl? And whenever something happens like this, everyone says, this happens on training grounds every day. It just happens all the time. Does it happen all the time?
No. players fighting with managers does not happen all the time. Like players bickering and fighting between each other is not all the time, but it's a regular occurrence, quite a regular occurrence. But fighting with your manager is is unusual. Yeah, for sure.
Steve Bruce confirmed he'd had this training ground row, said the leak to the press, Wilson, was, quote, borders on treason, if you like. It's disgusting. Would you say that's overstating it? Or would you say, you know, treason is the right word?
I mean, treason is the wrong word, just to be clear. I can totally understand why a manager would be annoyed at leaks coming out of a dressing room, but, you know, unhappy dressing rooms, failing dressing rooms tend to leak. And certain journalists are very well connected, particularly when they used to work for the club, as happened in this case. So it's the journalism aspect of it is great. You know, it's a great story to have been broken. I think it does show the significant disharmony there. Newcastle are struggling. I still think West Brom could get out of it. I mean, obviously, that's the kind of game they need to win. But there's still 10 games left.
Yeah, but so if you can't beat Newcastle at home, then you're...
Yeah, but you know, don't forget how many of these relegation battles I've been through.
Yeah, true.
And, you know, suddenly you become the first team to beat Jose Mourinho at Stamford Bridge out of nowhere, and you take 10 points in 4 games, and it looks very different. I think West Brom probably need 18 points in the next 10 games to have a chance.
Ed, what about Brighton? I mean, that game with Leicester was a game they absolutely should have put Leicester away. And as you're watching it, you're like, oh, Brighton aren't going to win this. And then to lose it, is just gutting for them.
Yeah, I'm still really surprised that they ended up losing it. But I shouldn't be, because it's just the way that they're just so... They lack the ability to finish teams off, basically. I think 17 points now they've dropped from winning positions, which is I think that's the most in the league. But it's just, I mean, Graham Potter just looked stunned afterwards. And I think, you know, they should be okay, because they have got a lot of quality, but obviously they need to learn how to score more than one goal, really. That's the key for them.
Last week, I interviewed a company that have developed this sort of a box where you can steam your football boots to make them sort of malleable, a bit like taking them in the bath with you, but you don't get them wet. And 19 of the Premier League clubs have this special steaming box where you put your boots in and the players stick them on and they're warm and toasty and soft and everything. And Brighton are the only ones that don't. And that could be a problem for Brighton.
And it is cold there at the moment. The other night it was absolutely freezing. You know, it's high up on the downs. And
just need to steam your boots. Must be why. Don't you? Spurs 4, Palace 1. James says, which sudden return is the most epic? Gandalf the Grey returning as Gandalf the White, Luke Skywalker's comeback, or Bale remembering that he's a talented player? I don't remember Gandalf becoming a different Gandalf, but I mean, I found those films went on quite a long time. Apparently there's a book of it as well. I can't go near that.
This season is going on quite a long time, though, to be fair.
It's true. Bale was brilliant, Ed, wasn't he? And
he was.
His not just the goal scoring, which was great because he's in the right place, but I thought his distribution, the way he zips a pass, you know, with pace and accuracy, it meant that they could switch the play really quickly, Tottenham.
Yeah, he looks almost back to his best. And Chris Coleman was absolutely loving it on the commentary, wasn't he? Yes, it was just seeing Gareth back on to his best. Yeah, I think it's really exciting for Spurs. Just to, you know, a shame for them that they're not yet close enough to get a bit higher in the league. But maybe top four is within their reach now if they can keep up with this momentum.
Simon says, why is no one talking about Harry Kane for player of the year? 16 goals, 14 assists is incredible. Wilson, why is no one talking about it? Are you talking? You're not talking about it.
Well, I think individual awards are pretty stupid in football. Probably because City are going to win a quadruple, so people think they have to give it to a City player.
All right. Harry Kane and Heung-min Son did combine for the fourth, setting a new record for the most goal combinations in a Premier League season. I'm worried that Heung-min Son, if Bale and Kane keep working together, will Son start feeling a bit left out of this? I mean, he seems pretty selfless bloke. He'll probably be okay. Lucas Moura was also brilliant in this game, I thought. The real Thomas Wilkinson says, should Mourinho face disciplinary action for playing Lucas instead of Lamella and ruining the dream of having squad numbers 1 to 11 on at the same time. Yeah, it was very, very close. And he brought Lamella on. He could have taken more off at that time and had a 1 to 11. Tord Swede Nielsen says, what's the deal with Ndombele's beige blanket? Please analyse the choice of blanket he had and the blanket that he gave to Harry Kane. When you were on the bench, Marcus, were you under a blanket? Phil, seems to me the only legitimate times for blankets are if you're an old person or if you're an aeroplane or if you're a professional footballer on the subs bench.
I think it's all changed now because they're more in the stands, aren't they? During the dugout times, blankets were not a thing. So, yeah, this is a new addition.
Oh, really? Would you have frowned upon someone covering themselves in a blanket?
Yeah, they would have got a lot of stick for bringing a blanket out. Yeah.
Sean says, I'm a Palace fan. I can't watch them or any football just now, or it bores me. Match of the day or times two speed and listen to Football Weekly to keep up. What can be done to help us all fall back in love with the game? Ed, you're a Palace fan. How are you finding watching?
I know exactly how it feels. It's almost like you're obliged to watch your team. Like last night, I just expected what happened. I had to watch it though, obviously. And but just generally, I understand what everyone. You know, I think it's just it doesn't help the layout of the games. You know that it's just constant drip of games. Just I think it's everyone's fed up of it now. To be honest, I mean, I love football, but having them on at different times and I quite looking forward to returning to a bit of normality.
What I think is interesting is what will happen next season. Will it go back to six games at 3 p.m.? Will there not be a Sunday? Will the TV companies think, oh, hang on, we could keep this kind of structure? I don't know how many fans would be keen for it, or would they possibly look at saying, look, we'll have six games at 3 o'clock, but that there'll no longer be that ban on a 3 o'clock kickoffs being on TV. Will iFollow stay for football league clubs? So like away fans can watch it, or will football league clubs think that'll stop money going in through the turnstiles? I'm interested to see what happens because I would very much like it to go back exactly how it was, I think, because I like six Premier League games at Saturday at 3 p.m. You know, I like there being, you know, two games on a Sunday. You think, right, okay, that's a nice amount for me to watch and be interested in. And, you know, that idea of, you know, when you go back years and years, you know, it's the same with like TV shows. You know, there was a time where you had to watch Grange Hills so you could, you know, you could talk about what had been on at school, right? But, or EastEnders or whatever. But now Netflix means people watch things at different times. But there are some times when there's a show that people watch at the same time and it makes it exciting. There are some times when actually if the Manchester Derby is the only game, you'd all watch it and be like, oh, I'm sort of part of a bigger thing. But maybe this is the most I've ever sounded like an old man. That's the alternative. No,
I agree. But the thing to say, I think, is that it wasn't ever six games on a... Well, it was before, but, you know, recently we had Friday night games, Saturday night games.
Yeah, true. Especially with Europa League, you'd end up with four games on the Sunday anyway. And
They'll want to do that, won't they, the broadcasters? But
the real problem is the evening games on the... Like, the latest game on the Saturday and the Sunday. Because obviously it's never the best game that day. So almost whatever it is, it just sort of feels like, I can't face this, I can't do this. So last night I watched the first half of the Spurs Palace game and then watched McDonald and Dodds, which is really not very good, I'm afraid.
Oh, really? Detective program?
Yeah, I think last night's was the best of the four so far, but it was still...
Are there too many detective shows? Is that the problem? It's not like the good old days when it was just Miss Marple and we'd all settle down for it. And now there's just too many.
Well, I think Unforgotten, which appallingly has been postponed till tomorrow night from its usual Monday night slot because of the Harry and Meghan interview.
The what?
The royal thing that was
No, I missed it.
Not even live. Reaction to that means that Unforgotten's only postponed by 24 hours.
This is the real problem with it. Now we've suddenly found out. I'm going to move you on, Wilson. Burnley 1, Arsenal 1. Goal of the day. Granit Xhaka to Chris Wood. I really enjoyed Chris Wood shrugging. And I did think about this. I think this is bad news for any Burnley fans who want at some point to play it out from the back. Because Sean Dyche just staring there watching it going, you see, that's what happens. Bernd Leno said, that's our style. There's nothing to worry about. I mean, at that moment, Bernd, I would say there was something to worry about. Marcus, Arsenal missed a hatful in this game, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. It was a pretty... poor display of finishing on that goal. I think, yeah, Jack has just got to play that first time. Don't know what he was thinking there. But yeah, he's prone to those sort of mistakes.
There was some good VAR when Eric Peters shouldered it over and was sent off and a penalty, and that was overturned. The other one was probably a penalty, Ed, where he sort of pushed it out of the way.
I think so, yeah. I think so. What I found funny about that game was with Xhaka, I can't remember who was on co-commentary, or I think it was in Match of the Day I saw it actually, and they said, yeah, he's not comfortable on his right foot, and then he tries to chip it over the defender in the penalty area with his right foot, and yeah.
Sean Dyche afterwards said, I think Mateo Vidra was kicked and went down, and it could have been a penalty as well, actually. If we dive more and squeal more, we might get more penalties. And we have heard players sort of screaming a whole lot more. And Match of the Day did a screamometer for Alexandre Lacazette. And then Lineker, Dion and Wrighty all screamed at the end of the show. I don't know if you saw it, Jonathan. I enjoyed it tremendously, but then I think Lineker, Dion and Wrighty can do no wrong in my eyes. But the screaming is quite noisy now, Marcus, isn't it? And I sometimes think it is really fatuous to make comparisons between amateur football and professional football. But I've been two-footed by really big centre-backs before. And I reckon that must be as painful as being fouled by someone in the Premier League. I don't know. They're probably moving at a quicker pace than we ever are. But the noise is quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very loud, and obviously with the stadiums being empty, it's even more. You can hear it a lot more louder. I think this is something that's a phenomenon that's been happening all the time. It's no different. Just the only difference is that we can actually hear it now. I think it's a bit embarrassing, to be honest. This doesn't put the game in a good light. We know that kids copy their players, and I feel sorry for the Sunday league coaches that now have got to go and police this on a Sunday with the little kids that are running playing football on a Sunday.
I have noticed, though, if you think about feigning injury in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot more rolling around. And I think where footballers have got better at it is they've realised that maybe they've seen some of these detective shows, Wilson, and they know that if somebody's really injured or dead, then they don't move at all. And so players have got much better at being totally motionless, like absolutely dead still, in the hope that the ref blows the whistle when there's an attack going on at the other end.
Well, and so go back to what I said when I was on a little while ago, because I have now found the clip of Brian Blessed screaming with his hand in a tank of water.
Yeah.
That screaming apparently does release endorphins, which lower the pain. So it does make sense, however unseemly it may be.
I think we tried to play a clip of that at the end of the pod, and the lawyers wouldn't let us. I can't imagine Brian Blessed suing us for repeating something. Anyway,
To be honest, I quite enjoy being sued by Brian Blessed, I think.
if that's the thing that we get sued for, you know, given some of the serious podcasts we've done, it would be quite the moment, wouldn't it? Go on YouTube. It is Stephen Fry watching Brian Blessed put his hand, getting electrocuted.
No, right? it's a tank of iced water. I thought it was boiling water, which didn't quite make sense. No. It was iced water. And for some reason, he's in an empty theatre. He's on the stage.
Yes.
And there's an academic there who's done this research that says that screaming and swearing increases your pain threshold. And yeah, it's Brian Blessed with his hand in the tank, and he does it silently and can only do it for a little time. Then he does it shouting bollocks a lot, and he can do it for much longer.
Yeah. There was no one in the theatre. I always thought Brian Blessed swearing with his hand in an ice was so much better with fans, wasn't it? I really thought that. It's nothing. It's Blessed swearing. It's nothing without fans, isn't it? Sheffield United 0, Southampton 2. Southampton's first win since the 4th of January, which was against Liverpool, obviously. 8 defeats and a draw in that time. Che Adams' goal with a great chest assist is all you need to remember from that game. And unless someone has something important to say about it, Aston Villa 0, Wolves 0. Emi Martinez has got his 14th clean sheet of the season, just one behind Edison in the race for the Golden Glove of all the pointless individual awards, Wilson. Because it's not really just for the goalkeeper, that is, it's for the whole defence.
Well, and also Martinez has presumably faced a lot more shots than Edison. Yeah, I think it's harder for him to keep a clean sheet than it is for Edison to keep a clean sheet. I reckon that on a good day, I could probably keep a clean sheet behind Man City's defence. I suspect I wouldn't do it behind Villa's defence.
Now, Monday night, Chelsea-Everton, big game in the race for the top four. West Ham leads. We'll round them up in tomorrow's Europod. Rob says, in advance of the Monday night game, you might want to mention Leeds' awful record in London. Stuart Dallas hasn't had a win in London since he played for Brentford, and he left Brentford in 2015. Something to keep an eye out for those of you who listen to the pod before those games tonight. That'll do for part two. Ewan Murray joins us for a Rangers celebration fit bar corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chris writes, doesn't Ewan Murray only come on for a crisis? Please lead with Celtic crisis as Rangers win the league. Below the line would be hilarious. Welcome, Ewan.
Thank you. Good morning. That did cross my mind. I do normally come on in a time of crisis, but it is a time of crisis for Celtic, I suppose. So if you want to spin it that way and take the reaction, then that's on you.
No. Come on. Let's give Rangers some credit. They won 3-0 on Saturday against St Mirren, which meant Celtic had to win at Dundee United. That game was on the telly next to the telly playing West Brom Newcastle. And between them, they provided arguably the least entertainment I've ever seen in two televisions side by side. But it all means that Rangers have won the title. A 55th league title for Rangers or a first league title for Rangers, depending on who you support, as far as I can tell. But Ewan, how would you describe this achievement from them?
It's hugely significant for Rangers. It marks the kind of completion of their comeback since 2012 and all that happened there. So, you know, if you're involved with Rangers or a Rangers supporter, you're quite right to regard this as massively significant and a massive achievement. And also that they've stopped, you know, Celtic were going for 10 in a row, which in Scotland is the, you know, the magic number. Rangers have halted that. That's a big deal to them. So all pieced together, it's a huge achievement for Rangers. I always, without meaning to piss on anyone's chips, I think some people overplay how incredible all of this is. I mean, there's only two clubs in Scotland can win the league. Rangers can spend millions on players. Rangers have 40,000 season ticket holders. I get in the Rangers sphere, this is a big deal. But in terms of how, you know, in wider terms, how incredible and amazing an achievement it is, I'm not quite so sure about that. But that's for another day.
In many ways, you and I sense you would quite like to piss on someone's chips. But
no, I just mean these are. I mentioned this morning, but Steven Gerrard was, of course, he was smart in taking the Rangers job. But one of the elements of that was that he could make mistakes and have problems in Scotland that wouldn't really resonate elsewhere. I mean, this is Rangers' eighth attempt at winning a trophy, which they've won comfortably. They've been the best team in Scotland this season by an absolute mile. And as I repeat, they deserve all the praise for doing that. But Rangers' earlier problems domestically were kind of ignored and no one bothered about them. And now all of a sudden, Steven Gerrard is the coming man of management, blah, blah, blah. But as I say, honestly, I don't want to downplay for Rangers how big a deal this is for them. And it's fully deserved. And, you know, they're entitled to enjoy it.
How impressed have you been with Steven Gerrard? Obviously, you know, he's not, as someone said here, can we focus on factors other than Gerrard? This is from Reheald. He doesn't play for them, you know. Like how much credit should Steven Gerrard get before we focus on other people, other players, that, you know, players who've been good?
He deserves credit because of how big a turnaround this has been. I mean, this time last year, it's funny, people will now reinvent history, but rewrite history rather. A year ago, Rangers had just lost at home to Hamilton. The fans were going ballistic. Celtic were running away with the league. You know, that what happened and the league didn't finish, but Celtic were going to win that league anyway. And it was a mirror image of the previous season where Rangers were good up to New Year and then pretty much collapsed. So at that point, there were a lot of questions around Gerrard and legitimate questions around Gerrard. But this season, Rangers have been imperious domestically. They haven't lost a league game. We're not to the League Cup at St Mirren, which was now no one really bothers about, but they've been, and they've lost 9 goals in 32 games. And also, this is an important point, that, you know, I tend to think the size of club Rangers and Celtic are, they should be prominent in Europe, but Rangers are in the last 16 of the Europa League where they haven't lost a single match this season. So that gives wider credence to what Gerrard and Rangers are doing. They are a good team beyond Scotland, but I think his biggest achievement is turning around what looked a pretty dismal, grim situation a year ago to the point where Rangers have been so formidable. And even by kind of October, November this season, they didn't look like a team that was going to ship cheap points, which was the problem in the previous 2 years.
What do you think is more important for them, like having a real tilt at the Europa League or remaining unbeaten all season in the Scottish Premiership? Because he could rest players in the league and you know, really go for Europe. Oh, I don't know, it depends how deep his squad is, I guess.
That's a good question. I would hope they look at the Europa League. I mean, they're playing Slavia Prague, who obviously a decent team. They put Leicester out. But Rangers, given how well Rangers have played in Europe, they should look to get through that tie and get into the last eight. I hope the time is a bit unfortunate. They're going to Prague for a game on Thursday, and their celebrations yesterday at least looked pretty epic. So I don't know what kind of condition the squad will be in. But I hope, this was my complaint with Brendan Rodgers when he was at Celtic. I think he focused far too much on domestic success and honours and records when there should have been a wider game at play. It strikes me Rangers has that, and Gerrard has that. He's spoken about, you know, this is just the beginning, this isn't the end of the journey, we have more to do. So I hope they look at the Europa League and look to keep going in there, because with some of the teams in that competition, there's no reason why they can't go even further. And as I say, a club of Rangers' stature and standing, that's where they should be.
I don't imagine you and you find it exciting to talk about whether this is their 55th or their first title. But, you know, we've got a lot of listeners who are not in the UK, who might not really follow Scottish football that closely. Can you explain why that is even a conversation?
Don't have to.
No, you don't have to.
Supporters of Celtic, and not just Celtic, actually, other clubs, will point out that because of Rangers' financial implosion, administration, liquidation of 2012, that this is a new club, and therefore this is their first title stroke major honour. I don't subscribe to that view, I should say. I think Rangers are Rangers and continue as Rangers. I mean, if 50,000 people wearing blue and white scarves go to Ibrox to watch a team called Rangers, and to be honest, the opposition, including or primarily Celtic supporters, treat them exactly the same, then it's Rangers. I can't be bothered at all with the legal, UEFA, etc. arguments about what the right and wrong is. As far as I'm concerned, it's Rangers. However, I do laugh. I mean, they don't quite get less is more, so the 55 titles thing is shoved down everyone's throats at every possible opportunity, as if to emphasise this is still the same. This is 55 titles, which I think is a world record, because it's one more than, I believe, Linfield have won in the Irish League. So if that's a big deal, then that's a big deal. But honestly, the whole thing, I find it pretty tedious.
Police say a small number of arrests were made and fines issued after crowds of fans gathered to celebrate. Nicola Sturgeon tweeted, "I congratulate Rangers on the title win, recognise what a moment this is for fans, but gathering in crowds just now risks lives, could delay exit from lockdown for everyone else. If those gathering care at all about the safety of the others and the country, they will go home." Look, Rangers aren't the first set of fans to celebrate, are they? What else could you say? Like pretty much every team who won something in England, a number of fans went and celebrated, even though some journalists said, how could you suggest that these fans might even celebrate, insert any team that won any division? I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I've read this morning, actually just before I come on, about sectarian breach of the peace and assaulting police officers, and obviously George Square in Glasgow was left in a bit of a mess, which has since been tidied up. Obviously the behaviour that leads to arrests should not happen. They clearly shouldn't be gathering in crowds, but you know what, on a basic human football supporter level, I understand that euphoria. I find it hard to get sniffy about it. And especially in Rangers' case, given all this backdrop that we've had, they've had 10 years of having the mickey taken out of them by everyone in Scottish football. This is such a big deal to them to win a title again. I don't deny them that. I accept they shouldn't be doing it. I accept that politicians will criticise it, and accept the police and other public services have other things they could be dealing with just now. But if there's one set of fans who would be euphoric after everything that's gone on, and also I think part of it's societal, isn't it? I mean, we've been cooped up for so long. I think when there's opportunity to do these things, people kind of seize upon it. So I without saying, yeah, it's fine, they can celebrate, which clearly it's not fine, they shouldn't be doing it, I do understand the emotion behind it.
Chris says, should Rangers immediately be stripped of the title for charging £7.10 for a bar of dairy milk? You can.
Was that real? I saw this. Was this a real thing for sale?
I see a picture. I mean, I've no reason not to believe it. Who knows? Pre-order now. Rangers Limited Edition Champions Cadbury Chocolate Bar. Rangers and club sponsor Cadbury have come together to create a limited edition Champions Chocolate Bar to honour the club's 55th title win from £7.10. So I don't know if they go higher for bigger chocolates. And half the bar is the purple dairy milk. And half the bar is the blue of Rangers with the Rangers badge, £7.10.
The Rangers online store isn't a routine port of call, so I don't know whether this was real or some elaborate hoax. What does a bar of dairy milk normally cost? I don't know.
Oh, you're so out of touch. You're like the Prime Minister. There you go. I don't know, about a quid, isn't it? Is it a quid now, probably? I remember when it was 25p. That's what it was. It 20p for a chocolate bar, 30p for a can of Coke, 10p for a chomp, always.
I'm just trying to establish the level of ludicrous markup they've applied to this dairy milk. That's all for some.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, but no, they're not missing opportunity. There'll be all sorts of things emblazoned with Champions. Again, fair enough. That's what clubs do, isn't it? But
yeah, true.
The dairy milk thing, I didn't know if it was legitimate when I saw it. So I'm glad you've clarified.
Well, I mean, I haven't clarified it. I don't know if it's true. But before Cadbury's and Rangers get on the phone, we're dealing with a court case from Brian Blessed right now. And so we currently don't have time for you. Anyway, Ewan, thanks so much for coming on.
Speak soon. Probably next season.
Well, when there's a crisis, I'm sure we'll find one. Ewan Murray, our Scottish football correspondent. Now, we had a lot of tweets about something called Football Index, which is like a stock market for footballers. You can buy shares in Jadon Sancho or Oriel Romeo or whoever you want to buy shares in. And Greg Wood wrote a piece in the paper which began, "The troubled online betting firm Football Index continued to, quote, mint and issue new, quote, shares in high-profile players just days before an announcement of big reductions in dividends, which crashed its market on Saturday. The news is likely to add to the anger and frustration of thousands of Football Index's customers who are currently unable to sell their own shares to retrieve money from the exchange without suffering huge losses." Wilson, can you explain what that means to me?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but my understanding of it is that the player's value is determined by performance on the pitch plus exposure in various media outlets, and you then get dividend payouts from that. And Football Index reduced the size of dividend payments. That then caused the value of those shares to plummet because obviously you're not getting the same returns. And then the newer story you're just quoting there, seems to suggest that they were producing new shares and selling new shares despite knowing, or very soon before this decision on the dividends was made. Now, what they said about the dividends was it was the only way the company could keep going was to reduce the payouts. But obviously, people who've invested in some cases, several thousand pounds in this have suddenly found that a decision by the company has reduced the value of what they own by a large margin. And they're hugely angered by that.
A Football Index statement published on Saturday said, "Over recent months, Football Index has sustained substantial losses. The board agreed a recovery plan aimed at stemming those losses while retaining the dividend payments at current levels. It was hoped that this would stimulate a market recovery. Once it was clear that the reduction and restructure of dividends to the degree announced was necessary, we suspended placing issuance orders and announced the reduction and restructure to customers as soon as reasonably practicable. There was no intent to mislead customers in these transactions." Slightly complex and pretty important in global football terms, Ed, is what's happening with CAF, the Confederation of African Football. Patrice Motsepe's status as the next president looks to be all but secured after his last eligible rival for the role, Mauritania's Ahmed Yahya, pulled out of the race on Saturday afternoon, the third candidate to do so since Friday evening. Motsepe is a South African billionaire. He's the only candidate left. The possibility remains that could change today, Monday, if the current CAF president, Ahmed, overturns his five-year FIFA ban at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. FIFA have said the four leaders have reiterated what unites them is much stronger than what could potentially divide them, and that, quote, this was the reason it was decided that they should join forces and form a team under the leadership of Patrice Motsepe. What does this mean, Ed?
Well, it's very dramatic, and it's, a lot of stuff's been going on in the background behind closed doors. Basically, a deal last weekend there was a meeting in Rabat in Morocco between Gianni Infantino, obviously FIFA president, and some of the candidates who wanted to take over at CAF. And basically a deal was struck behind closed doors whereby Motsepe, who is the owner of Mamelodi Sundowns Football Club in South Africa, I used to cover them when I lived over there, one of the big teams over there known as the Glamour Boys because they've got loads of money. So he was Infantino's preferred candidate to be CAF president despite not having any experience as an administrator. Obviously, he's a owner of a club and stuff, but yeah, not as an administrator. But Infantino wanted him to be the president, and so a deal was done whereby the other candidates will become vice presidents, and in exchange for their their support, they get to be vice presidents, and Infantino gets his man in CAF, even though it's supposedly an independent body. So, and yeah, the only stumbling block to this grand plan is if Ahmed is somehow exonerated today by Cass.
I mean, I think you just left because I basically took your room, didn't I, in Nick's house in Cairo with a couple of nations. When the CAF Congress was held in 2019, when there was sort of a FIFA overseer put in charge, Fatma Samoura, which had never happened before. Ahmed, I think there were a lot of problems with. I think the suspicion around him would lead you to think it was not viable for him to continue. But the way that FIFA have just sort of grabbed hold of CAF, I think is extraordinary and really not healthy for the game.
One note from the Football League: Oldham have sacked Harry Kewell. He won 11 of his 32 games since taking charge at Oldham. Just one win in six, seeing them slip to just 10 points clear of the relegation zone in League Two. Cambridge are second. Paul Mullen scored a 93rd. This is an abuse of power here. If you want an abuse of power, it's this. Well done, Paul Mullen, for that goal that made me jump off my sofa and actually cheer like a proper football fan at a ground when he scored in the 93rd minute. A completely undeserved 1-0 win over Walsall, but I'll take it. Lewis says, where are footballers getting their haircuts? I understand you may not know the answer, but it's kicking around my head. Marcus, you're a footballer. Where are they getting their haircuts?
They've all got live-in hairdressers, mate. That's what it is.
Is every single one?
obviously they're doing it a little bit illegally, but they've all got people that come in, they'll come into the houses and do haircuts, mate. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, in the grand scheme of the world, should we be exercised by this? Is anybody? I was looking at Harry Kane. He hasn't had his hair. You know, his is just getting sort of boofier and boofier. I'm a big fan of the footballers that haven't gone down that route and are just letting it all grow.
But presumably it is possible. Clubs can have presumably any number of coaches they want as long as they're within the bubble, right? So there's no reason why a club couldn't employ a hairdresser within the bubble, is there?
I've done my own twice. It's quite fun round the back. It's dicing with any. I mean, who knows? I've no idea what it looks like. But it's good fun to give it a go. Maybe my last one, since hopefully my wife will return at the end of this week, but we can't be sure. But thank you to the listeners who were happy to hear that she hadn't actually left me and actually had thought that she had left me. But we won't know for sure until Friday. That'll do for today. Covered most things. Jonathan, thanks for your time.
Cheers, thank you.
Marcus, thank you.
Cheers, thanks.
Ed, thank you.
Cheers.
Sid, Nikki and Lars join me for a Europod tonight.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.